Hello, I'm David Robertson. What you're about to listen to is one of five podcasts which the Religious Studies Project is presenting in association with the Non-Religion and Secularity Research Network. For those of you who don't know the Religious Studies Project, please take a minute to survey religiousstudiesproject.com, which features our weekly podcasts with leading international scholars on exciting developments in theory, method, and empirical study within the social scientific study of religion, in addition to roundtable discussions, book reviews, features essays, opportunities digests, and more. For those of you who don't know the NSRN, the Non-Religion and Secularity Research Network is an international and interdisciplinary network of researchers founded in 2008, which aims to centralise existing research on the topic of non-religion and secularity and to facilitate discussion in this area. The NSRN runs a series of events including a biennial conference and an annual lecture series, in addition to maintaining a vibrant website with extensive collection of resources, publications and listings for teachers and students working in the area of non-religion and secularity. And you can check out their website at nsrn.net. As the Religious Studies Project has a wider remit than this, we didn't want to fill all of our listeners' inboxes with five quite lengthy podcasts. Therefore, we have not made these podcasts available through iTunes. However, they are still available on the Religious Studies Project website and are linked to from the NSRN website. Due to the lecture style of the recordings, it is somewhat inevitable that the audio quality is lower than we would like, and that there might be references to PowerPoint slides or other events happening in the room. However, we know that these will be minor irritations given the stimulating scholarship you're about to hear, and we're very grateful for the NSRN working with us to bring you these lectures. This podcast in particular is a lecture delivered by Callum Brown entitled The People of No Religion. This was one of the keynote lectures at the NSRN's 2012 conference at Goldsmith, University of London, in July 2012. Callum Brown is Professor of Religious and Cultural History at the University of Dundee. He is a social and cultural historian with special research interests in religion and secularisation in the post-1750 period, especially in the 20th and 21st centuries, mostly in Scotland and Britain, but also Canada, US and Ireland. He is perhaps best known for his book The Death of Christian Britain, published in 2000, and his most recent book, published this November, is entitled Religion and the Demographic Revolution, Women and Secularisation in Canada, Ireland, UK and USA since the 1960s. Looking at demographic behaviour in the North Atlantic world and the correlations between gender change, the sexual revolution, changes in patterns and of marriage and cohabitation, and changes in religious ritual. He has also been interviewed previously for the Religious Studies Project on historical approaches to religion and losing religion in particular.
Thank you very much for the introduction, Stephen. I might be huge, but I've been working on it. I know nothing about tweeting, so tweet away, I'll be completely oblivious to it. I spend so much of my time, probably about 80% of my life that's in front of the screen, I don't want to spend it anymore. I come here as an historian, and I think there's a bunch of historians here speaking today. And I believe foundationally in the ability of history as a discipline to deliver important perspectives on the present day. Not only how we got here, but the trajectory of change. It's historians who can tell you what is happening now. We're the best at telling you what is the trend. Secondly, history has got something up its sleeve which, by and large, sociology doesn't have. That is, we've got the ability to use history to pinpoint periods of great change and thereby to look at what caused it. So historians are very good at identifying causes. So I'm making a plea for history as part of your methodology suite of skills. Our generation is living through a historic period. We are living through the rapid emergence of secular society, of a society unknown before in human condition. In nearly all of Europe, Australasia and Canada, and in some other places, some way behind, we can observe an historic change in human culture. Without state oppression or forced conversion, large numbers of people have been losing religion and adopting a position of, broadly speaking, no religion. This is unprecedented. And I think it's important for historians to be able to inform you of how unprecedented this is. There has been and will remain much debate about the precise descriptors to be used in regard to the intellectual and religious positions that are developing in our age. Notwithstanding, the direction of change is clear, from the religious to the non-religious. This is the trajectory in which we are embedded in now. That's not to say it's inevitable. I'm not a sociologist about predicting the future. I'm merely saying where we're at now. Historians and social scientists have been rather slow to come alive to this transformation. And I think the three reasons dominate why we have been slow. First, at the time when the process really gathered pace in the mid-20th century, scholars interested in this tended to approach it from a left-wing, mainly Marxist perspective. Somebody of my age, I was brought up with Marxist supervisors, all my colleagues as PhD students were Marxists, and one tended to become a fellow traveller. It was how the history profession worked in the 1970s. This implied that the decline of religion was an inevitable outcome of class struggle and could be seen in the radical hiatus of the 1960s, and particularly the Swazami Tower of 68. When the theory of secularisation really emerged in the 60s and 70s, this seemed to fit comfortably with this Marxist religious historiography and sociology. In consequence, the singularity of what was happening then and has happened since was rather ignored. Presumptions were made about the very nature of religious decline, which were limited and did little to permit a new evidence-based research to examine what are the causes. Second, the nature of secularization was intellectually separated in the academy from the nature of the secular. In the academy, secularization was seen as a process of church decline, led predominantly by class alienation and the laziness of 20th century folk in attending church. Much of the historiography of secularization dwells on people failing to do what they should have done in going to church. The study of the secular was seen as an intellectual development of atheism, led by philosophers in the academy and those in philosophy departments. And there was some focus by a very small number of scholars on small secular and atheist movements and by the labour movement. There was and remains a mismatch between the two, secularisation and the secular, in the academy. The rise of a secular society continues to be envisaged by many scholars in these two different ways. Nomenclature is confused and varied. You'll know the possibilities: secularist, atheist, apathetic, agnostic, speculative agnostic, freethinkers, rationalists, humanists, the no-religionists, and of course in the USA, the nuns. The terms are plentiful, and that doesn't even exhaust them. That doesn't even start, that's really sort of the base. Scholars in many cases are talking past each other, using different terms and not engaging with each other. And one of the reasons for this is an obsession with definitions. And I do think we need to get past an obsession with definitions. Digging a definitional hole, filling in somebody else's, is just going to be an endless process. Get past it, agree on the heuristic use of certain definitions, and just study them. A third reason for this state of affairs is the strength of the religious vision of having no religion. This takes two forms. First, heavy with irony, it is to report that religious historians are more numerous and more plugged into evidence and heritage of historical and sociological argument than those who are coming from a non-religious background. It is religious historians, and I'm using that term to mean those who come from a confessionalist background. They have been the quickest to respond and more creative in their response to the shock of the collapse of organized religion in Western Europe. in the last decade especially, I'm sure you're aware, there has been a vast outgroup of ideas from religious historians and religious sociologists trying to account for what has been happening in the last half century. Ideas such as believing without belonging, religious or vicarious memory in secular society, both to be attributed to Grace Daly, who we'll be hearing tomorrow. The desecularization concept, popularized in America by Peter Berger and again Europe by Grace Daly. To the cascade of material from the USA and Canada that suggests that the growth of nuns is a cyclical life process. The young leave the churches and then come back in middle age or elderly. Then there's the work of several North American scholars who, turning to Europe, have tried to suggest that Europe is not really secular and point out the supposed firm in the faith category of Catholic nations, especially Ireland. Well, they just got need to go to Ireland right now. Then there are the mostly evangelical historians who have been suggesting that what is happening is the decline of conventional churches being replaced by privatized faith in the home, the breakup of the parish system, which may be happening as well, but I don't think that counts for everything that's happening. The suggestion that faith is becoming enforceable more by Christianity as a pressure group movement than it is by a church. The re-Christianizing of the state through pressure group work rather than through conversionism, and so forth. These ideas have been multiplicating and have become extremely influential amongst church historians. If you go to our religious history conference, these ideas are out there. This is their panoply of ideas to explain what is going on. And I think it's important to engage with them. And like Steve Bruce, to say what you think about them. In general terms, in relation to all of these, I adhere to Steve Bruce. I'll leave it there. But there's an insidious aspect to the religious vision, my 3B here. This is the complex and sophisticated way in which scholarship on secularity has, year after year, tended to fail to move from a religious view, a religious vision, of religious decline. A lot of the language used by some scholars in the field adheres to the language of religious scholarship. And I think there are moral and ethical problems, quite apart from analytical problems, with them. One I will pick on, which is prevalent in some North American religious sociology, is the study of those who leave a religion as apostates. I adhere to an ethical principle that if somebody tells me to my face, I am a Christian, I believe him or her. The word apostate is a word that, by and large, I have never, ever heard past the lips of somebody who has left a religion. This is not used as a self-descriptor. I adhere to the ethical principle, you stick with what they describe themselves as. That's a really important ethical starting point to me. I will be the first to put up my hand to continuing to use religious vision when I should be questioning it, when I should be decentering it, thinking out of the box, turning on it, to use a linguistic term. I have been studying secularization for 37 years, but have remained stubbornly embedded in a religious paradigm. Now, this paradigm takes a number of forms. First, there's an obsession with conceiving my subject, certainly, as a negative. The decline of the churches, the decline of religion, the decline of ritual, the decline of belief, the decline of birth, deaths, and marriages according to religious rites. And the growth of atheism as a non-belief. The result of this is a lack of curiosity, certainly amongst my peers, into what happens on the positive side. What happens with the loss of faith? What is growing there instead? There's a historical obsession with belief, with non-belief, sorry, as victimhood. There are many of my colleagues who do splendid work in analysing the history of atheism. But perforce, before the 1960s, this becomes a history of a deviancy, because that's how atheism was treated before the 1960s. Remember the last time that somebody was imprisoned in the UK for expressing atheist views was 1922. That recent. Okay. So the whole of the historical field of study tends to be one dominated by the concept of victimhood. And I think it's important, certainly in the period since the mid-20th century, to get beyond that. Now, I know there's a vast amount of innovative research going on. This room is full of it. The field of study is going to be transformed. Some nations, with close to half the population being of no religion, there is a need to think about this vast demographic as in a holistically non-religious way. It is a demographic phenomenon we're on now. It's not just a philosophical one. We've got millions of people who are leaving religion. Millions. And that is very recent. This has only happened in the last 5-6 decades. The historian has a very particular and important task in this journey we're setting out on. And that is to construct an historical narrative. How did we get here? What is the direction of change? What is the pace of change? And that's what I want to deal with today. I want to offer you one way of looking at the historical narrative. It's got some of my own predilections, particularly in relation to the importance of gender. There are three methodologies I think are important, and I want to introduce you to. These are not the only methodologies, but I think these are important ones for historians to put into the melting pot. Can I just start? I'll start with the culture side. The collapse of Christian culture is the first concept which I played around 10 years ago. I published a book called The Death of Christian Britain, which argued that the period from 1800 to the 1960s was a period really when historians had previously exaggerated the extent of church decline. By the 1950s, Britain was still a Christian nation dominated by Christian culture, Christian law, and it was very, very difficult for somebody to proclaim themselves to be an atheist, particularly in the midst of the Cold War. If you said you were an atheist in the middle of the Cold War, then you had the newspapers up in arms and saying, "It's a commie." I've been reading a number of books which emphasise this. One is, if anybody's not ready, Tony Judd, the late Tony Judd, great, great perceptive historian. Published his very last book as he was dying, called The Memory Shelley. I've been reading it last week, and I recommend people look at that, about the state of religion in Britain in the 1950s. The second book, I can't remember the author's name, Catherine, somebody or other, called The 50s Mystique. Which is a takeoff, of course, of the famous feminine mystique of 1963 by Frieden. But in this book, the 50s mystique, it looks again at how the 1950s in Britain was a decade dominated by Christian culture. Then it all changed, and it changed very remarkably and very fast. Interestingly, I'm seeing your system is cutting off the bottom of my slides. This is the bottom line, which you can't see. Says this is a quote from the Sunday Times, 1964. Talking about, it is now respectable not to believe in God. Not that it was right or virtuous or desirable, meaning that in the last 5 years, public opinion in this country, that's the UK, has at last grown up enough to acknowledge that a man in public life can be a humanist, an agnostic, or even an atheist, and need not hypocritically conceal his views. That's 1964. And there are a number of people who make these comments between about 1963 and 1968. A real turning point in British culture. Secondly, the view that the late 1950s was a turning point was the view of the sadly forgotten broadcaster, Ludwig Kennedy. Can I commend to you a book he wrote about Britain's journey from God? I can't remember the precise title. My footnotes have gone packed away. But look up Ludovic Kennedy. He was a BBC broadcaster. Though he kind of concealed his atheism on air. And he wrote a book about Britain's Journey from God. It might actually be called Britain's Journey from God. And he said that everything changed in the mid-1950s when a certain woman called Margaret Knight, about whom I've just written and published an article, broadcast the first atheist lectures on the BBC Home Service in 1955 and caused a massive furor, in which the BBC was condemned as an agent of atheism and communism. And he wrote, Roosevelt Kennedy said, before Mrs. Knight, Britain had been a more or less Christian country. After her, it became a more or less secular one. Of course, levels of weekly church going have been slowly declining in Britain since the late 19th century, but this had not created a vast non-religious constituency. In an English survey of the early 1950s, though only 15% of people claimed to go be weekly churchgoers, almost a quarter of people claimed to go at least once a quarter, and a further 15% went less frequently than that, keeping up their church membership and affiliation. And that meant a total of 44% of men and 56% of women claimed to be churchgoers. There's a vast constituency of poor attendance. We don't have that nowadays. We have a society where there are a small number of churchgoers and a vast number with no church connection at all, other than for hatcheries, matches and dispatches, and even that is changing. It's in the 1960s when change comes, and I want to demonstrate to you why I think the 1960s are so important. I want to turn now to no religionism and the demographic revolution. This graph shows the Gallup poll results on levels of claimed weekly church or synagogue attendance in the USA, Canada, and Great Britain since the late 1930s. You'll notice that the data from the USA are much more continuous, virtually yearly, from the 1950s. You'll see that for the USA, there was a rise in church-going levels in the late 1930s to a peak period in the 1950s, and some minor decline through the 1960s. But broadly speaking, the USA shows a fairly steady level of claimed church adherence. Now, some of you will be aware of Marler et al.'s study of the 1990s, which questioned whether 42% of Americans did go to church weekly. And they came to the conclusion that the true figure, after very detailed research, was somewhere in the region of 24%, which leaves open a vast area of analysis for some enterprising scholar to study the question of differential levels of lying about religion in different countries. Why do 20% of Americans feel they should lie to Gallup? I think it's a really serious question. You'll notice that the British figures already were very low, GB, 30% in the 1940s, 14% by the 1950s, and it stayed broadly in the mid to high teens in Britain ever since. These are people claiming attendance. This is not actual attendance. Let me show you Canada. Oh, Canada. Canada has a very special place in the history of secularization. And I hope I'm going to be the person who puts it there. Canada has been forgotten, except by American evangelicals. Mark Knoll, the world's leading ecclesiastical historian, 4 years ago wrote a pamphlet called Whatever Happened to Christian Canada. And this is part of the reason he wrote that. You'll see that in the late 1940s, 67% of Canadians claimed to have gone to church or synagogue in the last 7 days. By 2002, this is down to 26%. This is a catastrophic collapse of Christian Canada, partly due to the very specific quiet revolution in Quebec. But it's not just Quebec alone. British Columbia, Ontario have suffered massive collapses. All of the prairies have secularized dramatically. The only part of Canada that's really held up are the Maritimes and the eastern side. Kind of very briefly run through, very briefly, some specifics of church adherence, membership claims. This one for Scotland is the most complete that I think is possible, and I've been collecting it for decades now. This covers all known data, and I've even put in some missing data by linear extrapolation between data points for adults and for children, Sunday schools, Bible classes, the lot, the kit, caboodle. And you can see that there was a growth of formal church connection from the mid-19th century to a peak around about 1904-1905. Blips for the two world wars, but broadly speaking a plateau until the late 1930s, from when a decline set in as a straight line graph. Now that straight line decline I'm finding in country after country. Right, straight line decline. Church of England, Easter Day Communicants. Different measure, percentages are lower, but don't be fooled by that. This is still measuring a real trend. Easter Day Communicants per capita, you'll notice a big blip for the Second World War, and they just didn't count them because they weren't obviously overseas. There had been some general decline from the turn of the century, but it is from the mid to late 1950s that serious decline sets in, and despite the short-term levelling off in the 1980s, the decline resumed in the 1990s. Wales is more problematic, and deserves somebody doing a proper study of Wales. Churches started declining earlier there from the Evan Roberts Religious Revival of 1904-5, with the exception of the church in Wales, which seems to have picked up a lot of the people leaving the more evangelical churches. Broadly speaking, Wales between 1905 and 1921 seems to have shifted dramatically from evangelical Protestantism towards communism, particularly the miners. Canada is more problematic because it's, like USA, it's a society with large numbers of immigrants completely distorting the data which you might put together. The graph shows the per capita decline of Canada's largest church, and from this you might think, oh, the peak was in the 1920s. But if you look at the absolute membership in the little table I've inserted there, you'll see that the peak is actually 1966 for this church. This church was growing quite dramatically until 1966. Then it collapses. Republic of Ireland, religious affiliation. Here we just have to use the census data because, broadly speaking, there isn't a Catholic category of membership. Here you can see, putting together all the data from the census, that this was a country very close to 100% religiously aligned until the end of the 1960s. Then the start of a straight line decline. Okay, somewhere behind the UK, Canada, but the direction's trajectory of change and the timing of when it starts is broadly similar. USA, more problematic here because of data problems. The longest string there is from Gallup asking about church membership. And this shows that from, it's USBC church membership, from the 1890s through to the 1960s, there was growing per capita church membership, particularly as the frontier areas were becoming better churched. They were poorly churched all the way through the history of the frontier, and progressively became better churched, reaching a kind of a plateau by the mid-1960s. The Gallup poll shows a small decline in church membership in the USA from the late 60s, but nothing significant. The series below that is a series put together by the Glen Mary Institution, and are probably the most accurate. But they serve to show probably the level of exaggeration of the other two series. We're talking about a society where, broadly, about 45% of the population have been aligned through membership with the church. Let me go to no religion. Canada, I think, is the first census organization in the world to start recording this in 1871. If anybody knows a nation that recorded these figures and published them, then please tell me. Ireland did offer it as a category in the Irish census, but they were not separately enumerated until 1960. Here you can see that, broadly speaking, the straight line graph, the solid line, is a proportion no religion. The histograms are religion not stated. You'll notice the religion not stated declines. People are becoming more committed to religion in Canada during the first half of the 20th century. Becoming aligned with the church becomes more necessary, part of citizenship. The numbers of those with no religion are well below 1% until 1961, and then it all changed. Straight line graph upwards. We're waiting for the 2011 results to come out. No religion USA, Gallup poll. The figures here in the 1950s were quite large, around about the 1 to 2% mark. A little bit doubtful about whether that is actually representing the true state of affairs in the American population in the 1950s. It's very difficult in the period of the Cold War to not be aligned with religion. Nonetheless, it shows a flat line through until the mid-1960s, and then it takes off. But if a jumpy wrote that, that tends to happen with Gallup poll figures, they tend to be a bit up and down. Note also the growth in the undesignated. The undesignated and the nuns after the 1960s tend to move together, suggesting growth of indifference and no religion. Something's happening demographically. Different survey, the IRIS survey, many of you will be familiar with, using the telephone polls. It started with the census one in 1937, after which the US Census did no polls on religion because it was unconstitutional. Here you can see the growth from 2.7 to 8.2, 14.2 in 2001, and 15% in 2008. See also the rise of don't knows. No religion Australia. Very useful, because they did a census three times in the 60s and 61, 66 and 71. And you'll soon see quite clearly from this, it's the late 60s when a dramatic change occurs. New Zealand, again, it's the 1960s. New Zealand, by the way, broadly speaking, according to census data, just census, not questionnaire ones, census data, is the nation with the highest proportion of no religionists in the world. Unless you know different. So, let me move on now to linking what's been going on here to demographic change. Let me start with sex. I've been conducting statistical analysis to link the changing nature of religious adherence, practice, alignment in the late 20th century in UK, Ireland, Canada and the USA to demographic change. Let me turn first to the gay and lesbian revolution. Very little usable data exists, and all of it is post-2001. Basically, I've searched high and low for usable statistical data to make correlations. I was able to do it for US data, which there's a series of qualified but good estimates of the gay and lesbian population of each American state between 2001 and 2005. And I linked this with the proportion of no religionists in each state. And the correlation comes out to 0.4345. I don't have the... I included here the statistical significance data, but it is in the book. If you add in the not stateds to that, not stateds plus no religion, relate that to the gay and lesbian population, it comes out to 0.5262. For those who are familiar with correlations in Europe, is to 1... One is a perfect relationship, zero is a very imperfect, it's a completely random. So this, in social survey terms, is quite a significant correlation. Can I move on to heterosexuality and the 1960s? There's quite a lot of data, particularly in the USA. In fact, American sociologists became obsessed with sex in the 1960s. And they looked to religion to try and account for religious change. This is merely one survey, one of the best I'm offering you, but my book has got a complete survey of surveys of religion and sex. Student sexual experience in 1967 in USA, Canada, England, Germany, and Norway. This is one particular survey undertaken by Lucky and Mass. This just to prove the sexual revolution, the extent of it by the late 1960s. After this, you can see that USA and Canada has got quite a low level of sexual activity claimed by women. See the figure for one-night affairs, only 7.2 and 5.9%. Females reporting coitus is below half. Turn to England, and okay, it's only one survey, but England is leading the way in conservative
one-night affairs. What about Scotland?
Unfortunately, there's no data on Scotland, but I doubt it. Because I was around then, and I didn't see that much of it. Well, I was at St Andrews, so I mean, that's just abnormal. It might be more prevalent in Glasgow. Germany, quite high. Norway, in some regards, high still. Europe altogether, much more evidence of a sexual revolution than USA and Canada. But there's much change going on there. Let me put some graphs on sexual change. One of the rates used most commonly by historians is the illegitimacy rate. I use the term, I know that term is out of use now, but historians use it because we are measuring the stigma. The point of this graph is to measure the stigma, and illegitimacy describes the stigma. Births to unmarried mothers doesn't quite do it. The term was illegitimate child. Right down to the 1970s. Canada was the first census body to ditch the term illegitimacy. Canadians are right at the front of PC. This shows that for each of the countries I was studying, there's a very, very similar graph of change. Even Ireland and Northern Ireland are in the mix. They're about 5 years behind, but even there, dramatic growth in illegitimacy and births outside of marriage from the late 1960s. You can see the blip for the Second World War, which kind of fits. Everybody knew this. Female students, almost all of them single, were increasing in number in the 1960s and into the 70s, and they were getting their hands on the pill from 1967-68 onwards, transforming the sexuality of young women. Kinsey found, as early as the late 1940s, that church attendance was the best predictor of women's sexual activity. That's a little known fact. And Kinsey was the first to identify church attendance as the best predictor. Better than social class, better than the level of education. The evidence for this mounted in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, as more and more sociologists were trying to explain the sexual revolution. And virtually all of them identify religion in one form or other as the best predictor of who was having sex and with marriage, particularly women. These studies showed, and they'll be detailed in my book coming out at the end of the year, that religiosity, and notably conservative religiosity, evangelical, fundamentalist, Mormon, Catholic, were the strongest determinants of sexual activity in an inverse relationship. Those who were outside of those categories were most likely to have sex outside of marriage. Liberal sexual attitudes were found in most studies to be strongly determined by religiosity, positively by Jewish and no religion. Those were the two categories which predicted sexual activity outside of marriage. And were far more statistically significant than region of birth, rural or urban type of living, type of birthplace, race or class. It's religion that comes number one for explaining the start of the sexual revolution. Religion and the family. Demographers, are there any demographers present? Demographers have a term called the second demographic transition, post-1960. Can I briefly explain what this is? This is a declining fertility, sex without pregnancy, contraception and abortion, rise of contraception and abortion, in mostly westernized nations, coupled with growth of a troubled traditional family, changing outlook on the female body, and diminished respectability associated with women. The term respectability disappears. And thirdly, liberalization of family and sex laws, contraception, abortion, divorce, decline of censorship, etc. A whole suite of changes which demographers measure with heavy statistics. The result of their analysis is that where in countries with a late advance of second demographic transition, notably Africa, South America, Central America, and parts of Southeast Asia. The second demographic transition, where it comes late, comes with late secularization. The countries with the most advanced liberalization of the family have the most advanced secularization. And even the USA fits this. The demographers account for a very complex state-by-state analysis of the USA, saying some states are secularizing and having second demographic transition in advance of others. And even parts of states. And California is a great case in point. Northern California, Northwest California, broadly very liberalized compared to other parts of the USA. Southern California is just like the Deep South. I associate much of what's going on to the changing position of women, their attitudes to marriage and to giving birth. Nobody's ever done this before. I went through all the demographic textbooks and nobody's done this. I grant, these are the crude marriage rates, there are other versions of marriage rates to use, but I grant them all from 1920 through to the present. See the enormous popularity of marriage in the mid-20th century? It dips in the 1960s and there's a huge surge at the end of the 60s. Now those of you who, one or two of you, were alive then, may recall there was a great fashionability about marriage in the late 1960s. All these pop stars marrying when they were 20. Do you remember the following for, is Paul McCartney getting married? Mick Jagger on his second one? There was a room. Huge celebrity culture around marriages. And this was part, I'm not saying it's a cause, but it was part of the real trendiness of marriage. And people, young people, particularly students, were actually getting married at university in the late 60s in the UK and overseas. It's from the early 1970s that the marriage rates start to decline dramatically. You see the graph line fall for all of the nations apart from the USA. The top line is the USA. There you can see the USA is increasingly diverging from white other countries. It's a country where conventional marriage has stayed relatively buoyant compared to other places, including Ireland. There's a foundational shift in the place of marriage in our society. Rise of cohabitation. Let me turn to cohabitation. First of all, in USA, 1990, I correlated, sorry, quick statistics for those of you. I don't know if any of you are into them, but I'm into them in a big way. I correlated proportion of Protestant conservatives by state against female age of marriage. There was a very strong negative correlation, minus 0.6736, meaning that where Protestant conservatives were dense in US states, female age of marriage tended to be quite low. Compare some different data, which you don't get for the states, unfortunately, it's unobtainable. Scotland, 2001 census, the 32 counties of Scotland, local authority areas, proportion who are cohabiting correlated against proportion who are no religion, 0.7845. That is really strong correlation. Those parts of Scotland where there's more liberal culture concerning family formation have the highest proportion of no religions. England is not far behind. It's 87 local authority areas. Proportion cohabitation against no religion is 0.6760. Just going to put some flesh on the bones here, and I appreciate. Topping the list of English local authority areas for no religion was Brighton. Brighton has the highest density of no religionists, 27.02% in 2001, and the highest level of cohabitation, 14.85%. At the other extreme of the English list comes the Merseyside Metropolitan County, including the strongly Catholic city of Liverpool, with the second lowest level, of no religionism, only 8.67% no religionism, and the lowest level of cohabitation in England, 7.75%. So, cohabitation goes along with no religionism. This is a demographic phenomenon we're dealing with. Other scholars have found the same for Australia. There's footnotes in my book. I put the figures in there. I'm not the first to draw attention to this correlation, but I think I'm the first start to look at it transnationally. Trying to describe what's going on here. The last statistical exercise I went into, which I don't have the time to describe statistically here, was to look at causes. And I look here at women's educational and work opportunities linked to women's religiosity. Now, by education, I took a single category of proportion of women who were graduates in the countries that I could obtain this for. Work opportunities, I took the female participation rate. That's the proportion of the women who are eligible for the workforce who are working, either part-time or full-time. And I found very strong correlations. Correlation between a high level of women's higher education and high level of female participation rate on the one hand, and high levels of no religionism on the other. And this was especially strong in Quebec. I find very, very high correlations between higher education and female participation rate in Quebec to explain the rapidity of change there. Quebec, if anybody knows, familiar with it, down to the 1960s, 95% of the adult population of Quebec claimed to go to mass weekly. Extraordinary. That collapsed in the late 60s and early 70s in what is universally known as the Quiet Revolution. Quebec flipped. It maintains fairly strong Catholic identity, but religious practice collapsed. And with it, one of the things that collapsed was Christian marriage. Quebec has got the highest level of common law, that is, cohabitation, marriage, in the Western world. They also have a very high level of female participation, which they didn't have in the 1950s. Another thing I found was that in the mid-20th century, when no religionism was very low, less than 2% of the population, poverty was a significant predictor. No religionists tended to be below the average, the mean wage. By the 2000s, no religionism was a major, when it was a major minority, affluence was an important positive predictor. In the USA, there's also been a racial change. No religionists have moved from being significantly black to much more white. There's been, if you like, a whitening of no religionism in the USA. On gender, the more women worked, the greater was female no religionism. That is my bottom line. And that still remains the case from recent sociological studies. Can I move to the last part of my talk? I think I'm doing reasonably well on time. The third part of my work, first part was a study of discourses, second, statistics and demographic change. The third is, let's get down to testimony and ask people, how did you lose your religion? I've been doing two things. One, I've been studying autobiography on both sides of the line. I've read more than 400 autobiographies of people who were alive in the late 20th century. To do this research, I spent a semester in Vancouver and did a lot of research, not in the university library, which is excellent in Vancouver, but in a public library, because that's where you get autobiographies. They were quite well stocked in both American and British, so I could actually do all in Vancouver Public Library. The other thing is I've been interviewing. I've been recruiting those who are dedicated no-religionists, who are members of humanist or atheist organisations in the four countries. I have to confess I haven't been to Ireland yet to do interviews, but I have interviewed people who were brought up in Ireland and who left it. The bulk of my interviews are Canadian, British, and American, West Coast American predominantly. So far I've done 66 whole life interviews. Those who do know oral history, letters I take them through their whole life, usually takes 90 minutes. Ask them about their grandparents, their parents, what religion were you brought up in, what happened in school, when did you, constantly through, take them through their life, when did things change? Can I briefly come up with my preliminary results? And these are, this is my next book, which I'm currently writing. Author 66, oral history interviews. About a third lost religion between 7 and 12 years of age. This is their claim. This is an extraordinary surprise to me. Interestingly, there's quite a bit of literature in religious sociology suggesting 7 to 12 years of age is an important age for the evangelist to catch the child, and that children can make a decision for Christ in those years. Maybe there's a position the other way. I do have a tame psychologist in my university who works on religion. I'm in consultations with him about how we could explore this issue of children. Because the ethics of actually getting down to interviewing 7 to 12 year olds, unless you're at the University of Cambridge, where there is no ethical approval system. I kid you not, none. So if you want to do research on children, go to Cambridge. But you can't do it in one university, that's for sure. Second thing, what I'm calling for the minute humanist sensibility. Humanists with a small H. The vast bulk of the people I interviewed found the term atheism far too negative and not a life philosophy. It didn't describe where they were. I interviewed the full-time leader of Canadian atheists, a man called Justin Trottier, and I said, how do you describe yourself? Atheist, humanist, free thinker, what? And he said, when am I in a philosophical moment, I will call myself an agnostic. Because you can't prove a negative. You can't prove the non-existence of God. Agnostic, a speculative agnostic is where I'll be at. If I'm in a context of movement, I'll talk of myself as a free thinker, part of a radical tradition. If I'm standing in debate, particularly on TV, and there's a lot of TV, you can see them on YouTube, if I'm in debate with an evangelical, I'll call myself an atheist, because everybody knows where I'm at. And quite a lot of people talk about this movement through these definitions, depending on context, which links in quite nicely to a bunch of literature on the nature of selfhood, that our selfhood changes in whose company we're in. We change. Lastly, amongst men, science and reason were the predominant causes they attributed, I found, to their change from religion to non-religion. Quite a number of those I interviewed were scientists and engineers, but more broadly, men will talk about science and reason, and will talk about those who they regarded as their heroes or heroines, well, mostly their heroes. For Brits, they'll talk about Dawkins and Christopher Hitchens. Americans, slightly older ones, will remember Carl Sagan. I don't know if many people remember Carl Sagan, if you know any heads there, who was an American astronomer who presented a very famous TV series on astronomy in the late 1970s, early 1980s, called Cosmos. He had a fantastic way of saying Cosmos. do look up Carl Sagan. And he's a hero of American atheists. The position is represented by a number of testimonies. Juan McLaren, born 1940 in Dundee. I never actually became atheist. This is an engineer. I never actually became atheist. I'm an agnostic. For reason of evidence. You can't prove one or the other. For that reason alone, and of course, Darwin was the same, agnostic. From Ontario, David Fowler. I think if someone asked me, I probably called myself an agnostic then. This is talking about late 1960s. And even with my own wife, Janet, we didn't talk a lot about these things. But I know we both agreed that we probably were atheists. But we didn't use that term. So sorry, it's dropped off the end there. Let me find a book. Sorry, I can't find my quote. I can't finish that for you. Sorry, it seems to have dropped off here too. My preliminary view on women is that Women are much less prone to volunteer rationalism in interview as a cause of their non-religious position. They will say it, but are much less likely to volunteer it. When they did raise it, it came off their other contexts for explaining their faith loss. It's usually family, relationships, community. Lastly, I sense that many women felt they should mention rationalism, particularly if they were a member of an atheist or a humanist group. They felt, I've signed on to this, it must be rationalism, I must mention it. That's my preliminary view. I haven't analysed all my interviews completely thoroughly. Trauma. Trauma was very important to female loss of religion. This is a woman, despite spelling as an American, spelling as a Leslie, denotes in the UK we didn't associate it as being a man. Leslie O'Hagan was brought up in Texas, although she was born in California, but brought up in Texas. And this is uncanny. I haven't got a clip, unfortunately. I guess I felt like an outsider there. Everyone had their church there, and I didn't feel I fitted anywhere. She tried very hard to accept Jesus into her heart, as she was urged to by school teachers and church and friends. And I felt nothing. What's wrong with me? I remember a horrifying experience where I had grade 3 at school in the Bible Belt. Everyone has a church and a religion, and everyone assumes you're a Christian. And we had to do a report, an oral report, on our religion and our church. But I didn't have one. And I remember that terror. I had to get up and tell a story about my dad was this, my mom was this. And he didn't believe. And this was humiliating, putting a child through this. That scarred me. Everyone said, she's not one of us. I grew up in the Bible Belt, just never feeling that I belonged there. The reason I didn't have a clip of this was that she becomes quite emotional through this. This is clearly a deeply moving and, as she said, scarring experience. She grew up into adulthood. Her route out was she had serendipitously met a visiting humanist from Canada who came back to, I think it's Houston she was brought up. They met, they got married, and both of them felt tried to live in Texas, didn't like it, moved to Seattle, and they felt much more comfortable in much more secular Seattle. Ooh, it's slipping. Well, that's scary. My whole world moved there. Bertrand Russell talks about a trauma of conversion in his autobiography. I spent, and this was at the age of 16, I spent endless hours in meditation upon subject. I suffered acutely, both from the gradual loss of faith and from the need for silence. I thought, if I cease to believe in God, freedom, and immortality, I should be very unhappy. So he talks about the trauma of intellectual conversion. And you do get that from that. Two quotes. This is from a man, Dick Hewitson, who was brought up in a Catholic seminary, became a priest in the Midwest, and this is the experience.
I got a job with the State Employment Service in St. Paul, Minnesota, and went to work there, which was a very smart move. But I still helped out in churches on Sundays, like when priests were on vacation. And from 67 to 72, that was 5 more years, I, in one way or another, was involved with the church. And in 1972, something was going on, and I was having a terrible time, particularly coming up with sermon material. You know, I could go through the motions of the services, but really trying to preach was difficult because I realized that I didn't buy into any of this. And it's kind of interesting because I sort of went full circle from not, you know, well, I didn't have any belief because nobody gave me any belief as a kid. But, and in August of 1972, I remember it so vividly. I went to Mass at this church in St. Paul that I went to when I was helping out somewhere. And I could not wait for that service to end. And as soon as it ended, I think I literally ran down the aisle. And out of the church again, somehow knew that I was never going to go to church again in my life.
And how long did the context for his coming out as a non-Christian was he was coming out as a gay man at the same time, which the church psychologist was trying to deny. He, as soon as he came out from Catholic Church in Minnesota, he upped and left to San Francisco, where he's now a leading light of America, of the San Francisco gay community. And he's got a great website where he talks about his atheism and his homosexuality. So if you're interested, just Google Dick Hewitson, San Francisco, and you'll come up. And all his extended family and friends are. So he's a great. And as you can tell from his laugh, he's a hugely, a man excited by life, well into his 80s. He did the right, he obviously did the right thing for him. Different type of trauma, which a minority of my older men experienced. This is Norman Bruce, who was a tank commander at the Normandy landings.
And of course, came the attack, where we attacked from Normandy to Caen, with pretty disastrous results, really. And a number of my friends were killed. And I saw the Padre came into action, you know, and blessed them all. This was a terrible time, and this made me feel that there wasn't a God, that couldn't be a God. This was absolutely ridiculous. Here were we, God lovers being killed by other God lovers. It made no sense at all. So I think it was in the midst of the battle that I said, oh, fuck you, God. quite angry. The other impressive thing at that time was that when night time came, one officer was left on guard beneath the night sky while the others took their rest. And when there were clear skies, the effect of the stars above on this sleeping battlefield was somehow very, very moving. And I developed a feeling that the universe was something that should influence one's life, that one should see oneself as a mere animal living under this gorgeous universe. So I had quite a sort of emotional feeling towards human life as animal life.
To summarise on the narratives, women place lots of religion in the context of social networks, family and social networks. Men tend to talk of a struggle within their heads. Women's narratives are complex, men's more straightforward. I worked it out in my head. It was irrational. God couldn't exist. I'm sorry, I'm simplifying the story. Men tend to talk of individualism, their own efforts. Women talk of a collective environment. Conclusion. I hope I've shown to you at least the need for an historical narrative, evidence-based, showing the dramatic scale of secularisation that has been happening over the last 70 years. The way I interpret it is by no means the only way. The more the better. But I think it's important to start from an acknowledgement of how much has changed in the last 70 years. And that this is, for most parts of the westernised world, we're in the midst of a dramatic and unprecedented change. Lastly, my argument, the process of secularisation, for me, is a dynamic triangle between demographic revolution, economic change, and also religion. Thank you very much.
If you enjoyed listening to this podcast, why not check out the other four NSRN podcasts or some of the other podcasts and resources on the religiousstudiesproject.com. Remember, you can follow both organisations on Twitter at ProjectRS and at the NSRN, and find both on Facebook as well. And you can subscribe to the Religious Studies Project on iTunes. Thanks again for the NSRN for working with us to bring these podcasts, and as always, thanks for listening.